The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian Football Weekly. The Stirling scratch, or was it? We'll get into the lunchtime bust-up at St George's. It's the second last chance soon for Wales, Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland. We get an almost free swing with the backup of a potential playoff place coming up. There are judgments handed down on Bernardo Silva and the guy who flattened the opposition manager in the Bundesliga. We'll discuss what we're all doing with our lives, which sounds quite scary, and we'll answer a few questions. And that's all for today's Guardian Football Weekly Extra. Before I introduce our guests, just a quick apology from Max. He can't be with us today because he has a development meeting for his new carbon neutral lube to aid lovemaking. Made from wheat germ oil and fog, Max is finally hoping to put sex at the forefront of the climate emergency, but he assures us that it won't get in the way of his commitments to TalkSport. Nick, how are you?
I'm very well, how are you?
I'm very good. We haven't met before. There's two newbies for me on the pod this week. You were telling me earlier on that you're at Ipswich Town's biggest fan in the media.
I did caveat that by the fact that there aren't many of us. If anyone knows of an even more high profile one, impossible though that must be, then please do write in.
There's the joke writer Tony Cowards, who some people will follow on Twitter.
Yeah, I think he's a lot more famous than me.
Ed Sheeran.
I think he's quite a bit more famous than
me. But in terms of in the media, there's very few people fighting Ipswich Town's corner, isn't there?
No, and there's quite a lot of Norwich City in the media as well, as including Paul McInnes of this parish. Oh. So we have to address the balance.
Oh dear, oh dear, oh dear. Salon Andy Hickman, how are you, Salon?
I'm a little bit hungover.
Yeah, why don't you explain why you're slightly bleary-eyed?
So, am I bleary-eyed?
Well, I'm trying to paint a picture for our listeners at home.
So last night we had a fundraising dinner for Football Beyond Borders, who I work for, and it was our autumn fundraiser, and we were lucky enough to be joined by Henry Winter and Mark Bright in conversation. Really good evening. Wasn't intending to go out, but then Henry continued the drinking and I went with him, and basically just wanted to learn more about Steven Gerrard and get his inside scoop on Gerrard's life. It ended in a conversation, and which I think I regret, where I may have said Naby Keita will turn out to be better than Steven Gerrard was.
Interesting. What is your evidence for this?
2013-14 Bundesliga season, Leipzig's first season in the Bundesliga, and I just got a bit obsessed with it at the time. I haven't watched the Bundesliga really since, but that season I basically watched every Leipzig game, and so much so that I actually flew to Freiburg to watch Freiburg versus Leipzig, and hoping to see Naby in the flesh, and he picked up a suspension and wasn't played. So I went all the way there, and actually I was in the Freiburg end, and Freiburg won 2-1. Timo Werner scored to put us one up, but I didn't even get to see Naby play. And my evidence is that season and how incredible he was. And as a Liverpool fan, have been waiting for him to just come good and be
recapture that magic.
Definitely.
Last but not least, the Guardian's first gonzo football journalist, a man as obsessed with the truth as he is with football, firing missives from his typewriter, a projectile fired from County Offaly, the Daniel O'Donnell for the Deliveroo generation, it's Barry Glendenning.
Oh, thank you for that introduction. You make me sound like Jessica Fletcher. I'd like to add Georgie Bingham to the Ipswich Town Media fan club. I'm not saying she's more high profile than Nick, although she is more high profile than Nick.
I think she's got quite a lot more Twitter followers.
Okay, well, let's start with the big story of the week. It's the scratch that launched 1,000 memes. Raheem Sterling has been dropped for tonight's Euro 2020 qualifier with Montenegro after a training ground incident on Monday involving Liverpool defender Joe Gomez. It was the day after they came together at the end of Liverpool's 3-1 win over Man City. Southgate said on Monday that the emotions of Sunday's game were still raw and that the decision to drop Sterling was made with the agreement of the entire squad.
But it's got a bit more complicated since. So it's come out that Southgate's wanted to send Sterling home from the camp, was convinced by the squad to let him stay and train. Then Joe Gomez was pictured at a training session with a little scratch under his right eye. Telegraph reporting that it could have come from one of those trying to separate the two. It's reporting The Athletic that when Gomez arrived at the training ground at lunchtime on Monday, he was shaking everyone's hand to say hello, got to Sterling, who snapped and said, "So you think you're the big man?" and tried to get Gomez in a headlock. They quoted a source as saying that food went everywhere. Nick, I mean, this is just something that men do, isn't it? When they're in a group together, you know, tensions flare from time to time.
Yeah, you know, spirits get a little bit high. I think it's a funny one. I mean, you wonder whether such an intervention would have been taken if England had a do-or-die away fixture with the Czech Republic coming up this week that they had to win to get to the Euros. But then to say that is almost to accuse Gareth Southgate of making a kind of cheap publicity stunt, which I don't think he is the type to do. So you're right, it's a very complex situation. I think it's difficult, isn't it, these days when you're an international manager, because I think Gareth Southgate is very keen to give England a club atmosphere, as in a football club atmosphere. And I think he succeeded in doing that. And the squad has clearly been a lot more together in the last couple of years, a lot more open, a lot more sort of charming in terms of the face it puts on as well. Like, personally, I like England a lot more than I have done in about 20 years. But can you govern these days like a club manager might govern in terms of the sort of punishments or smackdowns that you deliver? I mean, is being punished in this way by Gareth Southgate a bit like being sent to your room by the babysitter? You know, like, will professionals really see it that way? I just think it's all a bit unnecessary, because this kind of thing does happen behind closed doors at every training ground every week. And I think, I know that's a cliche, but it's by and large true.
That club management thing as well, that's the kind of thing Don Revie tried to do in the 70s and failed, and England players didn't like it. But now Raheem Sterling earns so much money, and he's got, you know, I sort of pointed out, he's got more Instagram followers, more Twitter followers than the FA. He is a bigger brand than the FA, and it's quite difficult then to impose this kind of discipline, surely, on a wayward footballer.
And I don't think for one moment that they disrespect Southgate or his authority. In fact, I know they don't. But when you've got the lads together for a week, 10 days, is it the most effective way to deal with things to basically leave a player out for half of that time that you're together, when you're not together again until March? There must be, is there not a halfway house in terms of dealing with it? I don't know, is the answer.
Solon, you were at the Liverpool-Man City game, and they had a little tussle at the end, didn't they? Was that something you noticed in the ground?
No, I really didn't. I've been thinking about this a lot this week, and the amount of stuff that happened in that game you do not pick up on if you're in the stands I think, obviously, it was a particularly engaging, incredible match to be at, and you are very much swept away by the atmosphere as a Liverpool fan, as I am. But, you know, the VAR decisions, I wasn't really aware of the controversy over that until I got on the train. I actually stupidly got a train from Liverpool to Manchester straight after. So I was surrounded by City fans who were all trying to tell me that Mo was offside. And I was like, I didn't know that was a debate. And I didn't see, kind of the handball shouts. You didn't see the tussle between him and Sterling. Saw Trent put Raheem into the advertising board. But apart from that, you're unable to pick up on those things, I think, in the ground.
Well, I hadn't really noticed it. And then it was the thing that got mentioned in the coverage of this tussle, or this falling out. So I tried to watch it again. It is impossible to find it on Twitter without suffering a barrage of no context Eddie Hearn. So if you like no context Eddie Hearn, it's a great thing to look for. But do you think Sterling's been treated unfairly, Barry?
No, not particularly. There is a case to be argued that if I did the same thing to someone in my office, I would be heavily sanctioned, possibly fired. But I think it's widely accepted the football environment is a different environment because my work doesn't entail me going around clattering into various colleagues from rival newspapers, you know, on a weekly basis. I think Gareth Southgate possibly would have preferred to keep it in-house, but just tried to get ahead of it because he was aware there was no way he could keep it secret because there are so many leaks coming out of the England camp. I mean, I've read one story about it, which was, you know, perfectly interesting in The Athletic. There were six names in the byline. Six.
Wow.
Six different writers, presumably several of whom have different contacts in the England camp or connected to the England camp. So you're not going to keep some things like that secret. And it's a slow week news-wise, so obviously the media have latched on. And I think it's very much a storm in a teacup, but I can totally understand why it's getting so much coverage.
Can I go back to something that you said as well, Ellis, around, you know, this is what men do. This is just what men do, right? I feel really conflicted on the issue because I think, on the one hand, I am a footballer myself. I get it. You have these emotions, these things are so intense and so passionate, and the day after you've suffered a defeat to your title rival, having to then go and see them, that's horrible. I play Sunday league and people are miserable at work on the Thursday after a Sunday loss, let alone when this is your everything in your life. And so I understand that and I get that. But the whole narrative around, like, yeah, this is men reacting to an emotional situation is difficult for me to square, because Raheem is someone who we all look up to, and he has this narrative around him, and rightly so. He has been a pioneer of speaking out around racism and his experience and his treatment from the press, and he's very much on a pedestal, so he's going to make mistakes, definitely. But I think I work with young people, and we work with boys, and we often talk about Sterling as a role model. And I hate the term role model, and it gets bandied around a lot these days. But Raheem's, on the one hand, acted in a way that is natural and emotional, and you can't necessarily blame him for it. And he's also got the added pressure of being this guy on a pedestal who always has to put every foot right, and he's either revered or he's vilified.
And he's under huge scrutiny as well. A scrutiny that most of us find impossible to imagine.
Yeah.
One of the reasons I said that it was just something that men do is that I'm a relatively placid person, I think. But I went on a stag do in the summer. 30 men who are all like me and quite placid and nice people, I would like to think. 2 hours in, I was shirtless, shouting, I was trying to jump over a fence, and I was really weird. I thought, what is happening to me? And when I used to do, like, minibus trips to watch Swansea play, you know, you leave at 7 a.m, my mum would drop me off, bye mum, bye, and then by 7:02 I've had a can, and you kind of feel yourself change, and all of that testosterone can cause people to react in strange ways. You talk to ex-footballers, there are training ground bust-ups every week, and it's one of those things. The bouncers in provincial nightclubs often say that it clears the air. You know, I remember talking to a bouncer once, he said, oh, the sound of breaking glass is sort of, it focuses the mind. And I think it's one of those things that is going to happen when you have 25 young men training, especially when they're under huge scrutiny, especially the morning after a massive game like Liverpool Man City that, you know, people are saying could alter the title race. So it's just a storm in a teacup, isn't it? You look like you're about to disagree with me, Salon.
I'm not about to disagree. I think that, so we talk a lot at FBB around football being a safe space for young people to demonstrate emotions and to feel and to, yeah, express themselves in a way that they often can't in a conventional education setting in a classroom. And obviously we're talking about the difference in I guess a lot of men being together and boys, and we talk a lot around, we'll teach social and emotional skills in the classroom, then we go out on the pitch, and it's amazing because it's the moment where the kids aren't, they don't feel like they're having to say the right thing or they're about getting the right answer. They're free and they can just act as they would naturally, I guess, and that's where the anger comes out, the frustration, the squaring up to each other, etc. And we see that as a really positive space because that emotion is there, so it needs to come out in some format. Football's a really healthy form for it to come out, and then we deal with it and we talk through those feelings and why they feel that way and get them to reflect on it. But it is a freedom that men have to be angry, and like you said, it's about loads of boys being together. They're a young squad, this England team. There's going to be testosterone, there's rivalries, etc. They have this freedom. It's boys will be boys as a narrative allows them to behave this way. Girls, the girls that I very much work with, there's a real problem with girls being able to express anger, and it's not okay for a girl to be angry, and you'll see the differential treatment a girl gets in a school if she's angry compared to a boy, and that's why I love football, because football allows these girls to get angry with each other, and I'm like, yeah, this is brilliant, get angry with each other, because that's a natural emotion, you're feeling it, and if you don't let it out in this way, it's going to come out in some other way that might be more unhealthy or might get you into more trouble. So do it now on the football pitch. I can't help but ask, if Steph Horton had gone into training and scratched Millie Brout's eye, how the response would be. I feel like it would be a very different, there seems a real like dignified response to this, like Southgate can come out, he can speak openly about it, he can be quite accepting, quite, this happens, emotions run high, Raheem can put something on his Instagram story, can put something on Twitter and say emotions get the better of us, and I'm not sure, I don't know if women would be able to have
would
that
be
freedom.
Afforded that luxury.
Yeah.
I don't really see why not, but you know, you know more about women's football and how it's perceived than I do, so.
But also, you know, I feel like I've defended men squaring up to each other. I mean, all of that stuff is why I stopped playing football after under 14s, because I hated it. And at under 16s, it was a lot more serious, and players got hurt, and I didn't thrive in that environment. Obviously, you know, if you've got to the representing your country stage and you are clearly able to handle that kind of stuff, I don't want to defend men squaring up to each other in the main, but I think you have to accept that's the kind of thing that happens. And yeah, I think you're probably right. I think that it would be treated differently in the women's game. And also, as a football fan, if I found out that the Wales squad were squaring up to each other, if I don't know, Gareth Bale was squaring up to Aaron Ramsey, then I would be unhappy about it, or if the same thing was happening at Swansea. But in the main, it doesn't seem to happen with England anymore, and I think there was an awful lot of it in the 90s and the 2000s, so that probably should be applauded. Another player in the England squad is Danny Rose, who's announced that he's not going to be offered a new contract by Spurs, and he's going to stay until his contract expires at the end of next season. Does he still have enough to offer at a very high level, Barry?
I think so. I'm not sure he has enough to offer perhaps what Spurs are after, but he seems very emphatic that he's going to stay for 18 months, you know, even if they do the classic make him train on his own with a personal trainer at 5 o'clock in the afternoon.
Yeah. But he is playing.
Yeah. Well, I mean, a lot of people expected him to go during the summer. He was left out of their pre-season tour, and it was widely assumed someone would make an offer for him, and apparently nobody did, which I must say I find surprising. I think he's a good player. And
he'll also be able to command higher wages if he goes on a free transfer.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that's...
But a year and a half is a long time, you know. Yeah. If he was sidelined and made an outcast, he might change his tune. I don't know. I'm not sure I would be able to handle the solitude and rejection of being an outcast in my own club.
On your own. If you made to write on your own.
Hasn't he spoken about just not... When football's done for him. Like,
yes.
He's ready to just stop. Like, why would he continue this game that he basically just doesn't treat him very well?
He's one of those footballers who doesn't seem to have a huge amount of love for the game, actually. I think it's a job for Danny Rose.
100%, and I can't really blame him. It seems to have, treated him poorly in terms of the racism that he's suffered and how it, that has, yeah, and other things and the pressure, etc., has impacted his mental health, and the fact that he can speak so openly about it. He's one of these footballers I find so interesting. I think he's, there's so many layers to him. He's totally, he's thoughtful, he's complex. It's an autobiography that I really want to read. So hopefully he does these 18 months and then goes, you know what, I'm just gonna stop and write my autobiography. Quite interesting.
But even allowing for the fact that he is a slightly different and more complex and possibly more erudite and straightforward character than a lot of footballers, it's still interesting that he is happy to put all this on record now, isn't it? And it's probably, I mean, without going into huge detail about what the problems may or may not be at Spurs again, I don't think you come out and do that if it's a happy camp, do you?
No. As for the games themselves, England will be through to the finals next summer with a point against Montenegro, but they could qualify even if they lose. If there's a winner in the game between second and third, that's Czech Republic versus Kosovo. If Kosovo win, they need just a point against England on Sunday to qualify for their first tournament. They only played their first official competitive game in 2016. Nick, but it'd be no less than they deserve how they played.
Yeah, they're a fantastic attacking team. I may have spoken about them a bit on this pod before, but they're very refreshing in international football terms, in that you look forward to watching them. They're very exhilarating going forward. They play with the handbrake off, as Arsene Wenger would have once said, and the progress they've made in the last 5.5 years is remarkable. I'm going out there on Friday morning to do previews and then to cover the England game. And if I compare it to the first time I went out there in 5.5 years ago for their first ever official game against Haiti, the difference is night and day. Back then, they were not FIFA or UEFA members. I remember going to their training pitch, which was rocky, bobbly pitch right under the most polluting power station in Europe, literally. The air quality was absolutely shocking. The pitch terrible. On match day, there was a virtual monsoon, and in the field walking to the stadium, the weather and the churn had unearthed loads of animal bones. So I was walking through sort of cow skeletons and stuff like that to the game. And the stadium itself had, you know, hardly any toilet facilities and that kind of thing. I don't think anybody there would mind me saying that. I'm not belittling their facilities then at all. It more shows the progress they've made since then, the incredible effort that their FA have put in, some fantastic people there who I know fairly well, and the players they have recruited, who are largely either refugees or the sons of refugees. A lot of them grew up elsewhere in Europe, and the passion with which they represent their country is absolutely extraordinary. And as I say, generally good team players like Milot Rashica plays for Werder Bremen. Bassant Salina, who Ellis knows very well, plays for Swansea. Very big depth of talent. And I think the visit of England in particular is going to be quite a big and quite emotional occasion for them. I mean, as we've partly said, there's a chance it could be virtually a dead rubber. But there's a lot of goodwill in Kosovo to the soldiers that came out as part of the NATO forces in 1999 from the UK and elsewhere as part of the effort to stop the war and then get the country back on its feet. And you know, I know from personal experience that if you are English in Pristina, you often hardly have to buy yourself a drink. You know, there's a real swell of goodwill. And I'm told they've got quite a lot of stuff laid on for England when they arrive. Lots of quite nice receptions, one or two of which I think I'm sworn to secrecy on.
For the England players, or
For the England team and the England fans, and also around the stadium. I think it might be quite a good spectacle.
Will they have live cows?
Yeah, they've come that far. I'm really looking forward to it, both, you know, from an almost emotional perspective of seeing what they have done and the incredible work that has gone on there. I could never have thought in February, March 2014 that they'd be playing a potentially crunch Euro qualifier against England five and a half years later. It just wasn't on the radar at all.
Well, that's enough for part one. In part two, we'll start with Wales, who are playing Azerbaijan and Hungary. Welcome back to part two of Football Weekly on November the 27th. It's the big one. It's the Indigo at the O2 in London. It's the last chance to see Football Weekly live in London for a while. It's a dream team lineup. It's Rushton, Glenn Denning, Wilson, James, as in me, Alice James. So that will be a lot of fun. On December 20th, Belgrave Music Hall in Leeds. It'll be Max Lars, Jonathan Wilson, and one more very special guest. And on January the 27th, this is sold out, although there are still one or two tickets left. It's almost sold out on the 28th. The Football Weekly team is going to Liberty Hall in Dublin, which is a cracking venue. I did that on my tour last year. It's fantastic. That'll be Max and Barry plus two very special guests. Homecoming, it'll be the brand new Barry Glendenning. I mean, you must be like a god at Liberty Hall, Barry.
No, I'm really not. I mean, I know your chum John Robbins went for his tour. Didn't he book about 17 shows in Bristol because he thought the homecoming of a comedy god. How did that work out for him?
The Bristol one sold out. I think he had a trickier time selling tickets in Exmouth.
Okay.
But, you know, I mean, Exmouth doesn't have... It's not John Robbins' country in the same way that Bristol is. But Liberty Hall will be
great. What does he call those big venues?
The Hubris Dome.
Hubris Domes, yes.
Yeah.
Indigo at O2 is our Hubris Dome.
It's our Hubris
Dome. So come along.
Yeah, do come along.
There
may be guitars.
There may be other surprises.
Do come along. And if you've got maybe 2,500 friends, bring them as well. That'd be great. Okay, on to international football. Wales. Wales are playing Azerbaijan on Saturday, and we're playing Hungary on Tuesday. Gareth Bale is back, apparently. He's apparently fit, despite having not played for Madrid since the last Wales fixture against Croatia. It's a very odd situation out in Spain. So on the line, we've got Sid Lowe, who's going to explain to me what is happening to my favourite person. Sid, tell all.
Hello, how are you?
I mean, apart
from being sad about Gareth.
Yeah.
There's one way to start this, I guess, which is to kind of resume, to resume. That's very Spanglish what I just said there, to try and resume it. To sum it up in the phrase that Zidane used in the press conference before the last league game. And he said, Gareth Bale is not injured, but he's not available. And of course, that immediately made people think, well, hang on. It's one thing for him not to play. It's one thing for him to be injured and to be trying to come back from that. But if you're saying to us, he's not injured and he is going to go with the Wales squad, and he hasn't played for us since he was last with the Wales squad, and that, of course, reinforced this sense that the breakdown now is complete. Now, obviously, the breakdown needn't necessarily have been there because he started the season, he started playing, he was in the starting 11 for I think the first three, maybe four games of the season, and it did feel like while the relationship was poor, it wasn't insurmountable in so much as he could continue to play. But this last month has been very, very odd, and it does feel like now there just isn't a way back. Now, I know we've said this kind of thing before, and in football there always is, but right now it just feels completely broken. It just feels like everybody's basically waiting for the end, waiting for the chance to get this resolved.
Well, he's being criticised by people like Tony Cruz, ex-players like Mijatovic, who said that for Gareth Bale, it's Wales, golf, and then Madrid in that order, which I should warn you, has now been turned into a T-shirt.
Yeah, I've seen a flag of it. It's brilliant.
Yeah.
I mean, personally, I think that's a brilliant idea to have a flag with that on it, to kind of poke the nose up at this accusation. And genuinely, the golf thing is extraordinary. You almost can't hear a single person in the media in Spain now or an ex-pro being asked without someone bringing up the fact that he bloody likes to play golf. I mean, it's become really quite obsessive. I mean, their obsession with golf is almost as extreme as his.
The amount of abuse he gets playing golf, he was on the front cover of AS, is it the Spanish newspaper, and it was triple bogey with three of the clangers he's dropped for Madrid. But I'm comparing him to Aaron Ramsey, who's extraordinarily popular in Turin with Juventus. And he seems to have done a lot of the things that Gareth never did. So Aaron's making a real effort with the language. He seems to be very happy to be there in Turin, and he does a lot of the media stuff. And even though his Italian isn't great because he's not been there for very long, he always starts his press conferences with the smattering of Italian he has, Gareth's never really mastered Spanish. He's never given an interview in Spanish, I don't think. Although Chris Coleman says that he's seen him speak to waiters in flawless Spanish, which, I mean, maybe that is true, but he's certainly not willing to do any media stuff. Is it that? Because if you look at his record with Madrid, he should be one of their most highly esteemed players, surely.
Yeah, I mean, look, there are a whole load of factors, but that's certainly part of it. I mean, I don't know Aaron Ramsey at all, so it's very difficult to judge this, but my suspicion is that the difference there is really a difference of personality. You know, that maybe Aaron Ramsey is that little bit more outgoing, that Gareth is perhaps more introverted, a bit shyer, doesn't want to run the risk of looking stupid in public and so on, and I think that's part of it. It's just partly about that, and I think what often happens with people who are timid or shy or introverted is that they get seen as aloofness, and it's not always necessarily that they are being aloof, and it's not always necessarily, by the way, that they don't care. And it's a while ago now, but I remember speaking to Gareth about this in an interview we did with him before one of the European Cup finals. And him saying, you know, I genuinely am trying with the language. You know, I'm just not very good at it, and I'm doing all I can, but it's really not working. And I think there is sometimes it's very easy for people to sneer and say, oh, look at him, he hasn't learned any of the language. And I think some people don't realise that there are people who try and learn language and just can't do it. And it is late in their lives to pick up a new language, and that it doesn't necessarily mean that they haven't made an effort. It's just that they can't get to that point. Also, again, I think it's partly about personality and how outgoing they are, about how much they impose themselves on people, how much they kind of get involved in the group, and shall we use that really horrible word, get involved in the banter with everybody else. And so I think there's an element of that. And you know, certainly this idea that, well, Gareth doesn't necessarily integrate, doesn't necessarily go out, isn't a kind of a big, huge personality. But in truth, that was the case at Spurs as well. You know, this is partly about personality. It's not necessarily a rejection of all things Spanish or all things Real Madrid, but that's certainly part of it. And I think have been times, and you know, this fits nicely with what you're saying about Ramsey, there have been times, I think, where Gareth could have done things that, even if they were largely empty, even if it was largely playing for the gallery, well, play to the gallery. Because, you know, they will influence the way that you're seen, and they will influence your experience. And they would change the way that you feel about being in Spain. And even if it had been empty, perhaps there's been times when that would have been useful. And as you say as well, you know, in terms of what he's achieved at Real Madrid, he should be a star. It is true, though, that there's been a lot of injuries, and people in the end get frustrated. And again, I think that's a little bit unfair on Gareth. There's this idea that, well, he gets injured, therefore we give up on him. Well, yeah, do you not think he hates being injured too? It's not like anyone gets injured deliberately, but it does reach a point where people wonder if he's doing enough to protect himself from injury, if he's doing enough to come back from it, whether, you know, there's that question mark which has always been there about pain thresholds and so on. And so that's part of it as well. But his what he's achieved in terms of statistics is absolutely brilliant. But it is also true, I think, that some people feel that given how much he cost, given how much of a star he was to be, they sort of wanted him to not just score loads of goals, win loads of things, but really, really dominate. And in particular, I think people wanted that after the departure of Cristiano Ronaldo. You know, that this was the guy that, all right, the path is clear for you now, go and be our absolute superstar. And actually, he's only had one season to do that, a season which was completely dysfunctional all the way through the club. It's not just about him at all, but he didn't do it. And that sort of led to this sensation, I think, this feeling at the end of last year that it just kind of, it had broken, really.
Sid, do you think Gareth Bale... Sid.
Oh, I lost you there. Sorry, say that again.
Sid, do you think Gareth Bale cares about the perception of him amongst Madrid fans?
Now, I don't know the answer here entirely. In that, I think he's aware of it, and I think it probably does upset him, and he probably thinks it's unfair. But I don't think it's necessarily going to. I don't think it's necessarily going to really bring him down. I don't think it's necessarily going to make him feel horribly bitter about it, but he certainly isn't happy. I mean, there was that very interesting line, I think it was probably when he last went to the Wales squad, and I think it was on in one of the press conferences or with Sky or BT or someone, and he'd said something like, well, I'm playing. I wouldn't say I'm playing happy, but I'm playing. And I think that, you know, it does affect him. I think it does irritate him. And so, for example, you get this kind of line that comes out from Bale's camp, which is, oh, he's not bothered, and they can say whatever they want, but it doesn't matter. But at the same time, then you then get the lines that they're irritated and they want a way out and they want a solution. And so the two things don't fit together. So I think while he maybe isn't demonstrably angry about it, yeah, I do think he's affected by it.
Just before we say goodbye, Sid, What's going on in the background? Is it lots of Real Madrid fans?
I'm so
fans?
Glad you asked.
Real Madrid fans shouting at you.
Is there a lot of funny noise? Well, I'm at Granada's training ground, and so the noise you can hear in the background is footballers playing football and shouting at each other. And that last noise was a man in a very, very big truck driving past with, you know, kind of gardening tools in the back. It's also, by the way, absolutely pissing it down with rain. And what a lovely club they are.
Right.
I was coming down to the south of Spain thinking, ah, it'd be nice and warm. It's pissing around the rain, it's freezing cold. They bought me one of those manager's jackets to wear.
Oh, nice. Because I must admit, it did sound like you'd agree to correspond with this podcast from a soft play centre.
Well, I mean, that's pretty much what this is. It's a soft play centre for adults.
Yes. OK, well, thank you very much for putting us in the picture there, Sid. We'll see you again.
Pleasure.
Cheers, mate. Well, Wales's result with Croatia last month at the Cardiff City Stadium, Wales 1, Croatia 1, means that Wales's destiny is no longer in their own hands in Group B. We're now relying on Slovakia dropping points in their remaining two fixtures, while Wales will need to claim 6 points from their final two games, away to Azerbaijan, obviously, and at home to Hungary. Should Wales and Slovakia finish level, Wales will qualify by virtue of their better head-to-head record.
I know you take a very relaxed attitude to the fortunes of the Welsh football team, Ellis. Are you confident?
Got no Johnny Williams, no David Brooks, no Joe Roden, who's been absolutely brilliant for us, no Joe Allen, who's suspended, although he's back for Hungary.
Who's playing?
Yeah, I mean...
You got Rambo fit for
Rambo
the first time
since November 2018. He hasn't kicked a ball in this campaign. So Ramsey has had minutes now, and he's come on a few times to Juventus. Bale is apparently fit and was playing well before his injury against Croatia. Midfield worries me. A lot of our good players aren't playing, so Ampadu's not really playing in the Bundesliga. Players you might have to rely on, like Matt Smith, they're not really playing for their clubs. After the last round of games, I really thought that we'd made progress under Giggs. I think we're going to be very reliant on Daniel James. What frustrates me so much is that in terms of the bottom seed teams, Azerbaijan are by no means the worst. And I really could do with us playing a Malta or an Andorra.
You haven't won an away game, an away qualifier in 2 years.
Yeah, since, was it Georgia, the Tom Lawrence game? Oh, anyway, we need to get a result out in Azerbaijan and then we need to beat Hungary at home.
Do you not need to win both?
Yeah. We need to win both. Somebody said to me the other day that I'm not glass half empty. I'm no glass when it comes to Wales. My instinct is that we haven't, with the injuries and suspensions, we might not have enough. But that is because I want it so much, I am unable to be objective about this. So I really, really hope that, with Gareth Bale and Ramsey, I mean, they're our two most important players. And Ramsey, when he has played for Juventus, has played very well. It's just he's had injuries, and obviously Gareth Bale is coming back from an injury. Fingers crossed. But if we don't do it, I will scream into the sea for 2 years.
Is he going to come under much pressure, Giggs, or do people realise that, you know, as you've mentioned, there's been a lot of chopping and changing, and they are coming off the back as well of such a successful team? I mean, he's obviously such a legend as well.
The noises from the FAW are that they accept that it's a transitionary period. A lot of our top players from Euro 2016 have either retired or been put out to pasture. Ryan Giggs seems to have this Logan's Run approach to anyone over the age of 24. He's obsessed with youth. So he's sidelined people like Sam Vokes, Ashley Williams, which has annoyed a lot of fans. A lot of our players have retired. He's sidelined Chris Gunter in favour of people like Connor Roberts. He really, really wants to stick with the kids and to get them to play expansive football. The last two fixtures we were trying not to lose. These two fixtures we're desperately trying to win. So it's going to be interesting to see how Ryan does that, because Azerbaijan's not an easy place to go. I mean, speaking realistically, I don't think the FAW could afford to sack him anyway, because our budget is small in comparative terms. So even if we don't qualify, A, there's the wild card of the Nations League playoffs, but I don't think his job is under any pressure. He's certainly not widely popular amongst Wales fans, I don't think. There's plenty who are very, very suspicious of Ryan Giggs' managerial nous, but I think he is here to stay. But let's talk about Northern Ireland. Michael O'Neill is in charge. He's just had his first game in charge of Stoke, but he will manage Northern Ireland in these two qualifiers against Germany and the Netherlands, as well as any potential playoff games next March, which is quite an interesting arrangement they've got.
Yeah, I find it strange that Stoke didn't insist he sever ties with Northern Ireland, because Stoke are in a big, big spot of bother. I suspect he will get them out of it, but if I was a member of the Stoke hierarchy, I would have not been hugely comfortable with this decision for him to not devote all his attention to Stoke. Stoke don't have many players on international duty, as far as I know, with the exception of James McLean, and he would have had 2 weeks with them to sort of whip them into shape if he hadn't, I presume at his own insistence, continued with Northern Ireland. One suspects they're on a bit of a hiding to nothing, but they because they have to play Netherlands and Germany, but looks like they'll get a playoff place, and it looks like he will also be in charge for that, which I find baffling.
And also, if they do qualify, Johnny Evans said it was a massive... that it wasn't a massive shock to the squad, him going to Stoke. And he thinks if they do end up qualifying for the final tournament, there's a chance O'Neill will be in charge again.
Yeah, that I think that might have been in a conversation that me and one or two others had with Johnny Evans after the Leicester-Arsenal game at the weekend. And Evans seemed, I was just looking back over the quotes now, he was fairly unsure as to what was going to happen. I think the dressing room seems pretty much in the dark as to how that would work. And really, if he did qualify, then you wouldn't want a new man in charge, would you? And if you had come that far into his dual management tenure, why not extend it for another 2 or 3 months? But I think there's a certain lack of information been fed down about how it's going to play out yet. I think he's got them drilled into such a good unit, hasn't he, in the last sort of 7 or 8 years, that you would hope it doesn't matter too much, but it's an unnecessary distraction, I think.
Well, defeat by the Netherlands on Saturday would end Northern Ireland's hopes of automatic qualification if Germany beat Belarus on the same day. However, it would not completely end Northern Irish ambition, because obviously there's a playoff place still up for grabs. Does anyone see them doing it automatically?
No.
But best of luck to them.
I could see them pulling off a shock win against the Netherlands at Windsor Park. The Northern Ireland are good at pulling off the occasional shock win against heavyweights at Windsor Park.
The Kenilworth Road of international football, Windsor Park. The Republic of Ireland, big news. Aaron Connolly, who's played a total of 22 games in senior football, is unavailable against Denmark, Barry.
Yes, he's out with a groin strain. So the Republic of Ireland are playing New Zealand in a friendly tonight, Thursday. I think Mick McCarthy is going to use the game as an opportunity to blood a few young players, Troy Parrott from Tottenham Hotspur among them. There's been a bit of clamorous people saying Parrott should be in the senior team.
He's 17.
I know. Well, people 17. Have been saying Robbie Keane was in the senior team when he was 17, but Mick McCarthy has made the important distinction that Robbie Keane was playing regularly for Wolves and scoring for Wolves when he was 17, whereas Troy Parrott is not playing regularly, if at all, for Tottenham Hotspur. You were asking me earlier, you know, to discuss Ireland's amazing success because they're top of the group.
Yeah.
But I've said before on the pod, I'm mystified as to how they're top of the group. They seem to... It's like Withen and I, we're top of the group by mistake. And it's kind of a false position because Denmark, who are level on points with them, and Switzerland, who are 1 point behind, have 2 games in hand. So the Republic of Ireland will have to beat Denmark to... almost certainly have to beat Denmark to qualify. We have played Denmark 400,321 times in the last 2 years and not beaten them at all. We're very good at drawing with them. In games that really matter, they tend to win 4 or 5-1. It's conceivable that Ireland might have to play Denmark, a Denmark that has nothing to play for, I think. But even so, Denmark hate us so much that they would probably try to beat us out of spite. You know, the last time we played them, Christian Eriksen was very complimentary. It was a lot of defending on their side, and we were trying to attack against 11 players in their own half. They play like this in every game we've played. In the second game in Ireland, they wanted to go forward, but they knew what happened when they went forward, so that's why they were too scared to go forward. That's something we've learned. Christian Eriksen, I think there's a simmering hatred between Ireland and Denmark, and we're both utterly fed up with each other, and hopefully after Monday we'll never have to play them again, ever.
Well, best of luck. Well, you do remain on top of your group. Troy Parrott, Centine, 4th of February 2002 was the day he was born. Number one in the charts was Hero by Enrique Iglesias. God, that makes me feel old. I'm old enough to be his dad without it being weird.
Oh, God.
I'm probably old enough to be his granddad without it being weird.
God. I didn't think they were still making kids in 2002. Oh, well, that's my own personal thing. I need to work myself. I need to work through that. Anyway, Scotland have got Cyprus away on Saturday and then Kazakhstan at home on Tuesday. BBC reported on Monday that the former Scotland international Kevin Gallagher said that he doesn't think that the current crop are taking international football seriously. These two games are irrelevant to Scotland's qualification prospects because they're guaranteed a playoff place. Do you think they're underperforming Scotland?
Well, when you look at the players they've got in certain positions, yes. I think they're a bit sort of top-loaded at left-back, aren't they, with Robertson and Tierney, for example. And I think it's interesting the comment about players not taking it seriously. There was a bit of a hoo-ha this week, I think, about a number of them who conveniently, I think, are all the best players pulling out with injury, which tends to arouse a bit of suspicion during international breaks. I can't remember who the five were, I'm afraid. I think Robertson's out and Tierney's out because he's still recovering from the hernia injury he had. But it is a funny situation where you can be in such a low point now, and the next two games I'm sure will be quite poorly watched, and no one's expecting much, and I'm sure the crowd for Kazakhstan at home will be minimal. But then you've got that chance 3 or 4 months later to turn complete ennui and boredom and apathy into a sort of crescendo where you qualify for the Euros for the first time in goodness knows how long, and everyone's happy again. It's a sort of funny thing about the safety net that the Nations League has provided. But I think that they should be doing better than they are, but they are a bit top-heavy in certain positions.
Okay. In Group B, the reigning champions Portugal will qualify with wins against Lithuania and Luxembourg. May not even require that much. In the squad is Bernardo Silva, who was given his punishment for the tweet he sent comparing Benjamin Mendy to a logo of a Spanish sweet brand, which depicted a racist stereotype. Silva's been banned for one game, fined £50,000, and has to attend an education course in the next 4 months. City won't be appealing the decision for fear that they'll have it increased. Could have been as much as 6 matches, but the independent FA Commission found that there were mitigating factors. The player did not have any knowledge of the historical connotations of the Conguito's character. His tweet was not intended by him to be either racist or offensive in any way. The tweet was promptly deleted by the player. The player and his club have taken steps themselves to ensure that the player has a greater understanding of his responsibilities on social media. The player made an early admission in full cooperation with the disciplinary process. The player has an exemplary character and disciplinary record. Kick It Out responded on Twitter by saying, "We accept Bernardo Silva's admission that he did not mean to intentionally cause offence and welcome the FA's move to provide education as part of the sanction." There we have it. Anyone got any opinions on that?
I think it's been dealt with in the right way, in short, and I'm very happy to see the educational aspect of it put in, because that's not always the case, or not always as visibly the case, and I welcome that as much as any other part of it, really.
I guess largely it's around the education's important, because when people do this, they don't get it. They don't get why that's an issue or could be perceived that way. So the fine and the sanction without the education is useless.
Yeah.
So it's a really positive step.
Righto, okay. Spain have already qualified from Group F. They play Malta and Romania in their final two qualifiers. They've called up some relatively new faces. Dani Olmo joined Dynamo Zagreb as a 16-year-old, is now 21. And from someone at the start of their career to someone coming to the end of theirs, former Spain international David Villa has announced that he'll be retiring in January. I watched YouTube compilations of his goals last night. Good grief. It's easy to forget, actually. But it was one of those weird YouTube compilations where it's voiced by what sounds like a robot. David Villa was a complete cold-blooded assassin when it came to the penalty box.
Very good.
Yeah, but he won Euro 2008, he took the Golden Boot, he scored five goals in the 2010 World Cup.
Have you seen what he's doing as well?
No.
He's part of a group who are buying or setting up a team in Queens.
In New York?
In New York, yeah, yeah. But he wants, his emphasis is on making sure that the team is made up of people from Queens. I think from his time, obviously, in New York, he's like, yeah, the district, it's a district, right? The district is full of a lot of footballing talent, so he wants the team to be largely made up of them. I think they're going to the second division in American leagues.
Very easy to get behind a team of local players, though. I would love that.
Yeah.
That's how football was in the 1880s. We'll end part two of this in Group J. Finland are very close to qualification. They just need a point from their game on Friday against the group's whipping boys, Liechtenstein, and they could qualify for their first ever major tournament. Nick?
Yeah, that'd be a fantastic and very, very unlikely a few years ago achievement for them. I remember maybe 3 years back going up to a city called Oulu, quite near to the Arctic Circle, to interview Daniel Amakachi, the former Everton and Nigeria legend who was coaching a team, a finished third division team up there, who I think he's still involved with. And I remember him saying to me, look, it's just so hard to get people into football here. They're all into their winter sports, obviously, and it's so difficult to engage people that football is going to be ever the number one sport in this country, but we will try. And now they're on the verge of doing it. They've got a very well-drilled team. The coach, Kenerva, is quite sensible. They're not that flashy. They're very compact. And they've got Teemu Pukki up front, who obviously until a month or 6 weeks ago was on fire in the Premier League and obviously last season in the Championship. And he's scored, I think, seven of their 12 goals in qualifiers. Quite a few penalties among that, but they all count. And his employers, Norwich City, are celebrating the fact that they will almost certainly qualify on Friday by holding a club night in Helsinki. I think it's at the Apollo Live Club, if there are still tickets available for any Helsinki-based fans. And they're holding a Pukki party with all sorts of canary paraphernalia, I think. So whatever that entails. So it's a weird fusion of
newspaper on the floor, little mirrors. Boxes of seeds and water hanging from the wall.
You would definitely want to be a fly on the wall in that and see how messy that gets at 3 a.m. So presumably,
I bet it stinks in there.
And I'm guessing that Norwich have seen you know, maybe some clubs like to break America or break Malaysia or break China, and Norwich see the Finnish market as something they can do something with. So maybe we'll see, you know, them giving a rock concert dressed as Lordi or something like that soon, with Daniel Farke dressed as the guy with the five skulls, you know. Or any other Finnish.
Delia Smith could start a restaurant in Helsinki or something.
Yeah, nice fish restaurant.
Yeah, very nice.
Herring, yeah. Okay. So that should be, you know, worth watching.
Okay, well, that's it for part two. We'll be back with you in part three to discuss some women's football. Welcome back. This is part three of Guardian Football Weekly, and England won in the Czech Republic 3-2 on Tuesday night. What did you make of the game, Salon?
Diabolical.
Oh.
It was awful. Again, we saw a terrible performance on Saturday at Wembley. And then again, we come out against a team who have absolutely no right to play, to get a result or on the brink of a result against that England team, and we just looked awful. I think, yeah, there's a lot of mitigating factors: the weather, the snow, the empty stadium, coming off of a high at Wembley, 77,000 fans, to play in front of no one in the middle of Czech Republic. But there was absolutely no excuse for that performance. I think Phil Neville tried to switch it up a little bit. I think that was refreshing to see. That was really welcome to see. I think everyone's wanted to see the partnership of Leah Williamson and Millie Bright at centre-back. And Steph Horton's actually been quite... I think she's been at fault for a lot of our defensive woes recently. So it was nice to see him trying that. He left Steph Horton behind, said it was a well-earned rest. But the defending was shocking. I can't believe we have some of the world's best players on that pitch, including the world's best right back. And it was so poor. Leah Williamson, I think, was at fault for the first goal, I think, and also the equaliser, I believe. If you looked at the back line, there was absolutely no discipline. It looked like they didn't really know what they were doing. I think we were lucky to salvage the result. We were playing a Czech Republic team that basically had a lot of players who played, I think, Slavia Prague against Arsenal in the Champions League earlier on, where Arsenal beat them 8-0. And then we went in and saw, yeah, Czech Republic went one. They had a chance in the first 5 minutes, and we just looked really cagey. It was quite funny watching, because the commentators went into catastrophe mode, and I was like, oh, it's fine. Like, it's first 5 minutes, it's Czech Republic, we'll be fine. And then we actually went a goal down. I feel like we did a similar thing as to what we did on Saturday against Germany, which was we didn't give respect to the opposition, the England team. Basically, the midfield took so many touches on the ball. Every time they received the ball, their back, a player was oncoming, and they just took about 7 touches and they just lost the ball. And we looked slow, we didn't look very sharp. It was just, yeah, one, I think going into that game was one, we'd won 1 in 7. And yeah, I think Phil Neville really needs to take a long, hard look.
He's under a lot of pressure, Phil Neville.
He is, and he what I found really kind of weird was he did an interview beforehand. I think Susie wrote about it in The Guardian. He said that I'm not coming under enough criticism. Everyone's giving me, basically he kind of implied, and he explicitly said, I think he said, the criticism of me is only half of what it should be. And I was like, that's kind of a weird thing to say. It's almost as if you're, there's a weird power dynamic in that's like,
ask for me to be sacked.
Yeah, you know, as if I acknowledge that that there isn't enough criticism in women's football, and you should take me seriously, and you should critique me, and because I'm here to speak really openly and say, you know, it's almost a bit of sort of like self-flagellation, like come and hit, like beat me more, basically. It was kind of a weird angle to take. I find him a fascinating man, but actually, no, I don't find him fascinating. I find him quite a dull man, but I find his managerial thing just really interesting.
I think 2 games ago, he had a go at a journalist for calling for him to be sacked, when in fact she had done nothing of the kind. It's like he says something, then completely blanks from his mind the fact that he's said it, and then come the next press conference or the next game, he goes, what would people like me to say?
Mm.
I think they'd like me to say the following, so I'll say it, whether I believe it or not.
The Dean Saunders approach to TalkSport. Yeah, it's because the Czech Republic are 28th in the world. Is there a big drop-off between the best teams and then the next best?
You would think so, but I think with the support and access to... yeah, professional contracts, training every single day, playing in really professional setups. You've got Lucy Bronze and Nikita Paris, who are playing at the world's best setup for women's football, who didn't look that much better than Czech Republic, who have a YouTuber on their team. Their centre-back, I think, is literally a YouTuber.
Is that psychologically maybe quite a difficult change for the England players? Because if you go back 10, 12 years, maybe playing Czech Republic would have almost been a level playing field, I guess, for a lot of them in terms of how they'd come through and developed, and maybe the club circumstances nearly. And now it's all so professional and so well organised and so sleek. Do you think there is a sort of psychological hurdle to get up for playing that kind of team again, or is that too much of an excuse? Almost?
Yeah, I think you could make that argument if the team was consisting of players, more senior players, who had gone on that journey and were now experiencing a lot of, yeah, the professional setup basically. But Jill Scott's really the only player in that lineup who was one of the players of that generation. Otherwise, you've got players like Nikia Paris, who, yes, played for a community club in Toxteth when she was growing up, but she's pretty much all she's known has been playing at Man City, playing at the Man City Academy, and then getting the transfer to Lyon. So she has known professionalism. The younger players have known that. Leah Williamson's another example at Arsenal, and it was really good to see her in the squad, and I was really, really happy to see Leah playing, but I was disappointed with how they performed.
Well, on to Wales. Wales kept their grip on second place after a scoreless draw against Northern Ireland out in Belfast. Wales are probably aiming to be one of the three best second place teams, as they're in a group with women's football giants Norway, who are a very good team, who are currently the fourth of and Wales are currently the fourth best of the second place teams, because we've only dropped points in one game with September's 2-2 draw with Northern Ireland in Newport. Before that, we'd beaten Belarus and the Faroe Islands. Another draw in Northern Ireland sees Wales move 4 points behind group leaders Norway. And we've still got home and away fixtures against them. They're a very good side, though, aren't they, Norway?
Yes.
Yeah, I'm scared of that.
Scandinavia have it right.
Yeah, and Wales came so close to qualifying for the World Cup in France that it would be absolutely massive if we reached the Euros. I'm desperate for it to happen. As you mentioned, Salon, Australia's Sam Kerr has signed for Chelsea on a 2.5-year deal. She was linked with most of the biggest clubs in Europe, Lyon, PSG and Barcelona among them, but said, "The WSL is the best league in Europe. I want team success and I don't want it to come easy. I feel Chelsea have been building something special over the years and I want to be a part of that. I want to lift some trophies." That's a big coup for Chelsea, isn't it?
Amazing. It's a real signal about the WSL as well. I love that she said, "I don't want it to come easy." It's almost a bit of a dig at Lyon for, you can go and play for Lyon, but what is it? It's just like, it's not really well-earned success, is it? You're going to smash everyone in that league. But yeah, I think it Sam Kerr in that Chelsea team is scary for other teams. If I was Arsenal right now, I'd be pretty scared. Man City as well. I think, yeah, it seems like Emma Hayes has got it right at Chelsea, but there's also a lot of forwards. There's now, you've got Beth England, you've got G, you've got Ramona Backman, you've got Fran Kirby, and now you've got Sam Kerr. Like, it's almost as if she's got too much to choose from. I wonder how they're going to play it.
She's the kind of sign like that will bring people in the turnstiles, isn't she? Like,
yep.
I would pay to go and watch her. Just
I want to see that backflip in person at King's Meadow.
In the Bundesliga, Eintracht Frankfurt captain David Abraham, the one who flattened Freiburg manager Christian Streich the weekend, has been banned for 7 weeks and fined €25,000. He'll be allowed to play in their final two games in the Europa League, but not in domestic competition until the start of 2020. Frankfurt are appealing the decision. Great clip, though.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely great clip. I watched it so many times. Just before we finish, we can talk about what we're doing with our lives. Salon, tell me about Football Beyond Borders.
Yeah, so I think the last time we came on in February, we just started programmes up in the Northwest. Previously, we'd just been based in London for the last 5 years. So since then, yeah, the provision has grown massively in the Northwest. So we've got a base now in Manchester, and we're in schools across Manchester, Blackburn, Blackpool, Burnley. I was up there on Monday. Yeah, it's a real exciting moment for us because, yeah, we want to have more impact and be across the country. I think the big thing, our focus at the moment is masculinity. And that's why the whole Sterling Gomez thing is really interesting, because it provides quite a live example we can work with young people in the classroom. So exploring masculinity, but also our model, we're adopting a football therapy approach now. So we're training a lot of our staff to be trauma-informed practitioners. So they're working one-to-one with the young people who are kind of most at risk of exclusion from school. We basically realised over the last 4 years of that young people, the schools are failing the most at-risk young people in terms of their emotional well-being because schools don't have the resources to be able to do it. We all know about waiting lists and things like CAMHS and all sorts. And we've realised the power of kind of helping a young person engage with their previous experiences and how that impacts their behaviours in the classroom, and what more powerful medium to have those conversations than football. So we've got these practitioners who are trained therapists and counsellors who are in a track suit doing these one-to-ones with young people with the ball at their feet and getting largely boys at the moment because there's more of a problem with boys being able to obviously express their emotions and that very much ties into the masculinity stuff. But having a ball at your feet and really unlocking what it is that's causing them to behave in the way that they are, and then really helping them work through the often really, really difficult experiences that a lot of young people have had.
That sounds fantastically important and edifying. Barry, you're off to find yourself in India.
Yes. I'm going to India to have a midlife crisis at the end of the month, which is utterly selfish and contributing in no way to anyone's benefit. So,
who are you going?
Ceylon is winning at the moment, unless yourself and Nick can come up with something better.
Who are you going with?
I'm going on my own.
Oh, I love this. I cannot wait for you to come back and be really zen. just a completely different Barry Glendenning.
Well, hopefully it'll be a more pleasant one.
I think you're pleasant enough.
Are we going to find you in 20 years claiming to be Lord Lucan in a forest somewhere?
Wouldn't rule it out.
Nick, what have you got on?
Well, I'm flying to Kosovo at 6 a.m. tomorrow. Before that, I'm going to see Tim Minchin in Hammersmith, but I've been told his show's about 3 hours long. And my flight's at 6, so I think it'll be about 2 hours sleep and then straight to Luton Airport. So maybe don't tell my editor about my lack of pre-match preparation.
Okay, all right. Well, I'll keep quiet if you keep quiet.
You're creating good vibes on the airwaves as well with your sidekick John Robbins, aren't you?
Yeah, we've got a new podcast that runs alongside the show I do on 5 Live with John called How Do You Cope with Ellis and John? So we've interviewed Adam Kay, who's a junior doctor, who wrote This Is Gonna Hurt. Emily Dean wrote a fantastic book called Everybody Died, So I Got a Dog. We've interviewed David Cottrell, talking about alcoholism and his mental health problems when he was a footballer. Tom Bradby, that's coming out on Sunday, I think. So yeah, you can get it in all the usual podcast places.
But it's very good.
It is very good.
Oh, thank you.
Would recommend.
That's very kind of you, but...
The only shortcoming I think it has is that I thought I had absolutely perfect mental health until I started listening to it, and now it's like Googling diseases.
You've unraveled.
I think I've got everything that all these people are talking about. I didn't think I was stressed. It seems apparently I am. I didn't think I was an alcoholic. It seems I definitely am. I didn't think, I suffered from anxiety. Yeah. Apparently I do.
It's the first step, as in the Dave Cotterill, the first step is acknowledging, isn't it? So at least you're being asked those questions to explore your own mental health. That's the purpose of it.
Tom Bradby suffered from horrendous insomnia. And I read a very interesting article in The Guardian. I could date it. It was September 2017, called Why We Sleep, What Those Late Nights Might Be Costing You. And since then, it's given me sleep anxiety. I never, ever had trouble sleeping until I read that article. And now, if I don't get 8 hours, I'm like, great, Alzheimer's, dementia, obesity, cancer, diabetes. It's called How Do You Cope with Ellis and John? And you can get it in all usual places. That's it for Guardian Football Weekly this week. Thank you very much for downloading. Goodbye, Nick. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ceylon.
Thank you.
The next time I see you, Barry, will be on stage in about 2 weeks' time at the O2.
Yes, so everyone should come along for what could be an emotional parting, because I could be a different man the next time I see you after that. It's your last chance to see this Barry Glendenning.
Before the reboot. Barry Glendenning version 2.0. Anyway, do come along to that. Max will be back with you on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.